From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
As Washington looks away, can big cities recover on their own? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Detroit, New York, and Boston are very different cities with something in common. Local politics are undergoing historic change. This month, all three cities elected populist new mayors who focused on unemployment and income inequality. Race wasn't an issue at all. Big cities like these are America's economic engines, but two-thirds have yet to recover after the Great Recession. Washington is no longer leading the way, so voters are turning to City Hall. We'll look at the opportunities and the challenges lying ahead. Today's talking point, how recycling and reuse drive the global economy. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Elections for mayor in Detroit, New York, and Boston turn more on class than race this month as multi-ethnic coalitions focused on economic recovery. With further help unlikely to come from Washington, are America's big cities now on their own? Today's talking point, there's big money in your recycling bin. You might even buy back a lot of that stuff you've been throwing away. We'll hear about a crucial aspect of the global economy that is mostly hidden. First, this news update. Scores of tornadoes hit seven Midwestern states yesterday, leaving paths of death and destruction. Alex Ruscianno is news producer and reporter for WCBU, Peoria Public Radio. Susan Newton of Washington, Illinois, a town of 15,000, told him this story.
We have neighbors that have lost their entire home, and last night we were at a dinner party at friends of ours, and their home is gone. Gone. There's nothing left.
Alex Ruscianno, thanks very much for joining us. I understand you are walking down the streets of Washington right now. What do you see?
Yes, the authorities here in Washington have allowed reporters to walk the streets, and I'm walking down one of the what used to be a subdivision here, and most of the homes are completely leveled. There are residents going through the rubble of their homes. Some of the homes are still standing. I just had a resident give me a tour of what remained of her home. Walls are completely down, and right now what's on everyone's mind is just salvaging as much as they can and trying to get as many items before the winter temperatures start to set in.
What about the human cost?
Yes. You know, there was at least one person who died from the tornado yesterday in Washington. There was about 50 to 70 people treated at area hospitals. But here, residents are telling me as I'm walking down the street and talking with different residents that the biggest thing people don't understand is how much psychologically it takes to process something like this in terms of how quick it came on, how little some people have left, and just what's the best way to move forward.
I understand there were winds there of 170 to 190 miles per hour.
The winds were extremely high, and they remained so yesterday and still today. You might be able to hear a few of those wind gusts around me, but residents are battling winds as they continue to batter what remains of their home. So, yes, the winds continue to be very high.
Is this unprecedented in Washington?
Certainly, it is unprecedented for the area. And, you know, residents in Washington and in central Illinois, like many people in the Midwest, you know, usually are used to tornado season. They're always kind of watching the radar to see what could pop up out of nowhere. But many residents have told me that I've spoken with that they were also surprised at just how quick this was and just how this came up in a matter of moments. Complete neighborhoods were destroyed. So they're also grappling with that.
I understand you went to a conference, news conference by the governor, Pat Quinn, today. What do you have to say?
Yes, the governor was there along with lead state emergency management officials. And basically, they were there to take a tour of the damage as well, but also to update people on next steps. And basically, the main message is that state officials are starting the long process of going through people's homes, different properties, and doing damage assessments. And the reason that's important is, in the next few days, if they can get enough damage assessments, then you can start to make a request for federal disaster declaration assistance. You can get better numbers for insurance and really just try and help residents get a better hold on financial options for them as well.
What about shelters in the meantime? Are there some available? Are people living with friends? What are they doing?
Yes, that's a very good question. Some residents have told me that they are living with relatives, but the Red Cross here, the Central Illinois Red Cross, has actually partnered with several community groups and also several churches in the area to literally open their doors where people can get food, water, shelter. They can drop off clothing. Also, there's even a few shelters had medical teams treating people and continuing to treat people from injuries. So people are either staying with a relation or trying to seek shelter. But some residents, like the person I just spoke with, they're staying put. If their homes miraculously did not get too damaged, they're spending the night in their home without any power in the cold and just trying to salvage through.
So there are homes then, and I take it many of them, most of them perhaps, that are still okay.
You know, there are homes, and as I'm walking down the street here in Washington, you can tell where the tornado hit because many of the homes are standing, but as you continue to go down the street, the damage gets worse and worse and worse, and eventually you just get to a place where you can't really tell what street you're on anymore. There's just an incredible, just block after block, where homes have been completely leveled. So some residents where they haven't been declared uninhabitable or where residents are choosing, they are trying to repair what they have overnight.
And the weather right now, it seems okay? You don't expect this to happen again?
You know, weather right now is actually, you would think it's just a gorgeous November day. It's sunny. There's nothing but the slight breeze in the air. That's the only thing that remains of the storm. We have heard some reports that being the Midwest and being this crazy temperatures, that this weekend there might be some more severe weather on
okay.
the way. But residents seem to have been preparing as best they can, either with help from shelters or from family as well.
Alex Rusciano with Peoria Public Radio, many thanks to you. In a moment, as Washington looks away, can big cities recover on their own? On To The Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. New York's new mayor, Bill de Blasio, campaigned against what he called the two cities presided over by his billionaire predecessor, Michael Bloomberg. In Boston, the white union leader Marty Walsh got crucial support from minority candidates and won with a multiracial coalition. In Detroit, Mike Duggan became the first white mayor elected in a black-majority city in 40 years. What do all three of these cities have in common? Jennifer Bradley is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program and co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. Good to have you on our program.
I'm glad to be here.
How are these cities representative of what you call the Metropolitan Revolution?
I think each of these cities in their own way understand that the changes that need to be made in their economy, in closing wealth gaps, in integrating immigrants and low-income people into society, the changes have to start there on the ground. There is no external force in the form of their respective states or the federal government that's going to come in and solve all of their problems. So the mayors in these cities, the newly elected mayors, have the opportunity to start building coalitions and building networks of people there on the ground and saying, okay, what are the resources we can all put towards either accelerating or changing the trajectory of our economy? But it's got to come from them first.
The three states involved, New York, Massachusetts, and Michigan, are pretty different. Are they all failing to come through and be helpful to these major engines of their economies?
I think there are often somewhat tense relationships between state capitals and state governments and the governments of their large metropolitan areas. States have a tendency to want to spread resources evenly throughout the state as opposed to focusing on their metropolitan engines. Certainly in Detroit and Michigan, that's an unusual relationship, right? Because people believe that it's the governor and the state that's pushed the city into bankruptcy court. So it's not, it's sometimes that states have a sort of hostile or ambivalent relationship. In other cases, it's the fact that the state doesn't have a lot of resources at its disposal either. States are also having to dig themselves out from the Great Recession. States are having to figure out what they're going to do with their state university systems or state education systems. So there's a feeling that the states are wrapped up in their own problems or are trying to safeguard their own political prerogatives and are not always well positioned to come in behind and in support of metropolitan engines. Of the states that you mentioned, I think that New York does understand, the state government does understand the power of cities and metropolitan areas and the benefits that can come from empowering them to make their own decisions with economic development. Governor Cuomo has gone quite far in that. I do think, though, that Governor Cuomo wants to support some of the more northern cities in the state of New York and wants to bring, you know, Syracuse and Buffalo and Rochester and the not New York City parts of the state up to speed.
I understand that of the 30 largest cities in the United States, 21 of them have still not fully recovered from the Great Recession. So these mayors have a lot to do.
Yeah, they do. The mayors are not, however, working alone. You know, one of the things that confuses us, I think, when we talk about cities is there's the city in terms of the city government. There's the city in terms of a geographic space. And then there's the city in terms of an economy. And that economy is actually a broader metropolitan area economy. So if you look at the largest metropolitan areas, 65% of the 100 largest metropolitan areas have output levels, GDP levels, above their post-recession peak. So governments are strained, but the overall economy of the metropolitan area in many places is doing pretty well. The challenge that mayors have is to get together with these networks of other drivers of metropolitan area. That's labor, business, community groups, university leaders, you know, whoever's on hand to help, get everybody together and say, okay, guys, here's what I, as city government, can bring to the table for economic revival and redirection. What can you do? That's what we see in successful metropolitan areas. It's what Mayor Bloomberg did when he created the Applied Sciences NYC undertaking, which is going to bring a lot more graduate talent and graduate engineering talent to the city in the hopes of creating new spinoffs and a stronger technology sector. He didn't do it all by himself. He worked in partnership. That's what's going to drive these places forward. And so that I hope the new mayors appreciate, I think they have a pretty good understanding once they get into office that they can't do it all. So their task is to reach out across sectors, across municipal borders and say, we all have a stake here. Let's all put our resources on the table. Let's all set a vision and figure out how we can make this community, not just City Hall, but the broader community, as strong as it can be.
Bill de Blasio, though, in New York City, campaigned against Mayor Bloomberg, even though Bloomberg wasn't running for re-election, by saying that he was presiding over two cities. There was a lot of talk in all of these elections about income inequality. What can city leaders, what can mayors do about that?
I think in the first instance, mayors can bring people who have been left out of the conversation and left out a feeling that they've been ignored back into the subject of urban life and remind us that one of the glories of urban life is its potential to move people up the income ladder. It's the ability of people from all walks of life and all income levels to integrate and live together and share, you know, great space and great amenities. More specifically, I think what mayors can do is look at their education system and see how well people are being prepared for school-to-work transitions and how well they're being prepared for the science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Most people say STEM. We say STEAM economy. The STEM economy holds enormous promise for people who don't necessarily have a bachelor's degree but have high school plus. And I think what mayors can do is take an inventory of their community college systems. This is what Mayor Emanuel has done in Chicago. They can take an inventory of their other workforce support systems and say, how well are these systems preparing people, from all parts of the city, for these emerging jobs in science and technology? And how do we increase that pipeline? Because this is how you can move people into the middle class. And I think that is an absolutely crucial and compelling thing. I think another thing that mayors can do is look at their metropolitan transportation systems. Poor people need not only the way to get economic mobility often starts with physical mobility. Are people in poor neighborhoods well served by public transportation systems? A lot of our public transportation systems are designed to bring people from the edges of a metropolitan area into the center and not necessarily around the perimeter of the metropolitan area. That's something to look at because a lot of low-income people are having to make those moves. So is there a transportation system that supports their economic mobility desires?
Jennifer Bradley at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. Aaron Wren is publisher of the Urbanophile website. He's a contributor to City Journal, published by the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
How important do you think the issue of income inequality, the sort of two cities argument, was to the various elections that we've seen this past month? And how would you define what's referred to as the new urban liberalism?
Well, I think it obviously played a huge role in the New York election. I think things are a little bit different in Detroit. I don't think this is really an urban issue. I mean, if you look at the nation as a whole, our national macro economy has become a two-tier economy in which I wouldn't call it the top 1%, but certainly the high end of the economy has done very well, while kind of the traditional middle-class economy has really been in a vice. So I think mayors and what's going on at ground zero in cities is the same sort of thing that's basically been playing out. I don't really see this as resulting from per se mayoral decisions. But what you do see is, you know, mayors who sort of, I think as Jennifer said, realize they are on their own. They have to respond to this macro economy. The high-end economy is doing well. So they do end up chasing high-end jobs in businesses like finance, professional services, high technology, biotech, and they're just going where the market is growing and they are catering to those. And most cities really don't have a lot of leverage in the marketplace. They sort of have to cater to those businesses. And I think they have to some extent neglected the middle class and the poor because there's not an obvious answer of what to do. De Blasio kind of exploited that with demagoguery, but I actually think it's the two New Yorks is far less true there than it is in other places, and he really doesn't have an answer either.
Let me turn to Thomas Edsel. He's professor at the Columbia Journalism School, op-ed writer for the New York Times, author of The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Thomas Edsel, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
Are you surprised that in none of these instances, none of these mayoral races, at least directly, race was an issue?
I was quite taken by the fact that in all these races, race is no longer the issue that it once was.
That's what I meant to ask. Go ahead.
I grew up next to Boston where race was a dominant issue with busing and Louise Day Hicks, famous fights going on. And in the last election, really both candidates had biracial support. And the winner, who came out of working-class white Dorchester, had very strong support from the black and Hispanic communities. The same is true with de Blasio. There was none of the Dinkins-Giuliani kind of tension in the election, and a lot of it was replaced by basically a class division in those two cities, which I'm most familiar with upscale voters voting for the losing candidate and downscale voters of all races voting for the winner.
Do you think that that is going to be a perpetual issue, or that it's going to be longstanding in American politics?
Well, I think if you look at a larger picture, if you look at the Democratic Party and the direction it's going, it's really moving towards a coalition that is dominated by the downscale. That there is an elite wing in the Democratic Party that has been actually quite influential and dominant, you could say. But Obama, whether he likes it or not, has helped create a coalition that is much more shifted towards a downscale point of view and addressing that has a constituency that has real needs and a constituency that supports government providing help in meeting those needs.
Let me go back to Aaron Wren. Do you think the Republicans have a chance to prevail again in some of these major cities, or are they out of business? Is it a matter of one Democrat versus another?
I think the Republicans are out of business in most cities. You know, I think they've got their own version of this sort of populist revolt, and it's called the Tea Party. And so they've kind of got their own version of the revolt going. And part of the thing is that the Tea Party mentality really doesn't play at the big city level because it tends to treat government entirely as a fiscal engine in which your only goal is to pump less money through it. And, you know, Ronald Reagan famously said the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." But that's not true when the fire department shows up or an ambulance shows up. And I think people at the local level expect services to be delivered effectively and efficiently. That was the secret to Giuliani. It was not necessarily tax cuts, although he cut taxes and he shrunk welfare rolls. But this idea that he made New York governable again, and the drop in crime and the delivery of services were key to Giuliani's success. I think the Tea Party influence in the Republican Party today makes Giuliani-style mayors less likely in a lot of places, although there are some of them out there, like Mick Cornett in Oklahoma City.
Tell us a bit more about him.
Well, he's a Republican, and he's probably, Greg Ballard in Indianapolis is the mayor of the most populous Republican city, but it's probably the second most populous city in America governed by a Republican. Had a community that was really took a blow, similar to New York after 9/11, in the federal building bombing. That was probably kind of what they were best known for. And they have really focused on not just maintaining kind of conservative governments and low taxes and low business regulation, but also have put in place a large capital program that's built a lot of high-quality parks and waterways, investing in quality of life. They're looking at various transport initiatives. I think there's like a $750 million or so program they call MAPS-3 underway right now, which was a ballot initiative that raised taxes to spend money in the city, paying cash, by the way, not borrowing.
But these are smaller cities that don't have the kind of issues that we're talking about in New York, Boston, and particularly Detroit.
Oklahoma City is probably bigger than the city of Boston, the municipal limits.
Okay. I'm sorry, I've got to interrupt. We need to take a break. We're going to be back with this conversation on our talking point, how recycling and reuse drive the global economy. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about how 21 of America's 30 biggest cities are still yet to recover from the Great Recession. And in three of them, Boston, New York, and Detroit, just this month, populist new mayors have been elected without race being a factor. That's unusual, according to Thomas Edsel, once again at the Columbia Journalism School, author of The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Tell us more about how you think class issues have now trumped race in city politics.
Boston really shows the divide. Almost all the upscale riverfront communities, part neighborhoods in Boston, voted for John Conley, whereas the low to moderate income neighborhoods in Dorchester, Roxbury, all those, it's like a line across the city, very explicit.
Connolly was the loser?
He was the loser.
And the winner was?
Marty Walsh.
Go ahead.
At any rate, the same pattern was true in New York, although de Blasio won so big, it's not as easy to see. But I think you have a sense now that more affluent people realize that they are going to have to pay if the less affluent take control, that the less affluent constituencies want to raise taxes and the more affluent constituencies do not want to pay those taxes. The more affluent would much rather see, they're not conservatives, but they would rather see reforms that are not costly, i.e. school reforms and changes in policy rather than in actual fiscal tax collection and big spending. So I think there's going to be a real tension in cities. You asked earlier whether Republicans could make gains in cities. I don't think that Republicans are going to be successful at all in winning control of cities, but they do have the opportunity in statewide contests and in presidential elections to potentially increase the percentage that they get out of cities as these class divides become sharper, assuming that they do become sharper.
Thomas Edsel at the Columbia Journalism School. Kenneth J. Cooper is a freelance journalist. He's editor of the Trotter Review. That's a journal on black studies and race relations at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Oh, it's good to be here, Warren.
Do you agree with Thomas Edsel that, in fact, class now has trumped race in these major metropolitan areas? Here we have, for the first time in 40 years, a majority African-American city, Detroit, electing a white mayor.
Yeah, I wouldn't go quite as far as Tom does. Certainly here where I live in Boston, class was certainly a factor in our mayoral election, but I wouldn't reduce it only to that. And here's one reason. It's the intersection between race and class that, given the demographics of the black and Latino communities, more of them are working class than are of the class that the loser John Conley is. So in some ways, people were voting for people who are like them. I also think in Boston, the question of municipal resources and the prosperous residents not wanting to pay more taxes isn't that much of an issue here, because the mayor is constrained in how much he can raise taxes each year by state law anyway. And basically, each mayor figures out how much money he needs for the upcoming fiscal year and adjusts the tax rate sort of by fiat. So I don't think that's really the concern. I think the people in Beacon Hill and other prosperous neighborhoods who voted for John Conley were voting for somebody who they felt was more like them. And the same with people in Dorchester and Roxbury and black and Latino communities who voted for Marty Walsh because culturally they felt he is more like them.
So is culture, then, more important than race?
Well, I don't mean culture in that sense. It's sort of like the character, the manner. I mean, John Conley is a very polished guy from a privileged background. His father was a good Massachusetts Secretary of State. His mother was a judge. He went to fine schools, and he has that kind of refinement about him. Whereas Marty Walsh is a more rough-hewn character, who's probably not as smooth, but he also represents a sort of smooth transition from our current mayor, who is also sort of the common man variety, even though they're both Marty Walsh and our current mayor, Tom Menino's, are college educated. They're more working class characters in terms of their background and their manner. So I think people are just more comfortable with
What about Mike Duggan in Detroit, the first white mayor in a black majority city in 40 years?
Well, I think, as I told somebody in Detroit not long ago, I think with each successive black mayor, the symbolic value of having a mayor diminishes each time. So my sense is that the predominantly African-American electorate in Detroit was mostly interested in trying to who could fix the problems. It was a pragmatic vote, and they didn't really care one way or another what color the mayor was. They just thought Mike Duggan was better prepared to fix, to address the immense problems that that city has.
So, Thomas Edsel, back to you. Who do you think it is that gains if there is an emphasis on class and culture and people like me rather than race?
Well, it depends on what level of campaign you're looking at. I think statewide, this could result in increased alienation of the city from the state government. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but it could. If the state, which tends to be more whiter and more upper middle class, sees the city as wanting to be a taker, to use Mitt Romney's kind of image, then it could threaten the relationship between the city and state and isolate cities. Conversely, though, the country as a whole is moving in the direction that the cities are already in terms of their demographics. And the Democratic Party, but in the next decade, will become majority-minority. And the country as a whole will become majority-minority in roughly 2050. The cities are on the leading edge of that change, and it's difficult to predict with any sureness who wins and who loses out of that process in the transition. The transition can often be very difficult and very controversial.
Let me go back to Jennifer Bradley, our first guest at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, about this transitional period, and ask you, isn't it going to be difficult for big city mayors to bring together the kind of coalitions that you talked about earlier if people are voting according to the patterns that we have heard about, and if there's a possibility of alienation from the states, which aren't helping them out anyway at the moment?
I think that one common thread among all the observers is that people want mayors who they believe will get done what needs to be done. And I do think that this kind of pragmatism, by and large, trumps ideology. I think you could even read the de Blasio election, right, as people saying, I want somebody who's going to get stuff done for me. I want my particular concerns on the agenda. And these were less broad ideological concerns and more about what's my job situation? What's my kid's school situation? Is the infrastructure in my neighborhood up to scratch? So I think that when you build from this base of pragmatism and getting stuff done, that's a great place to create a coalition. And one of the things that I find in my research, and it's in my book, The Metropolitan Revolution, is that mayors who are able to reach out to other mayors across jurisdictional lines, this often means Democratic mayors from big cities working with suburban Republican county executives or mayors, if they can find common ground, as has happened in Denver most spectacularly, they can deliver a lot of value for their constituents in terms of economic development, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of having a whole metropolitan region that feels like it's prospering together. So I think that if newly elected mayors and others can look at successful metropolitan areas and see that in many of these places, collaboration trumps, you know, competition, grandstanding, ideological tug of war, they'll emulate that. And I think that will work out for the best because fundamentally.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to go back to Aaron Wren again with the Urbanophile website, contributor to City Journal with the conservative think tank Manhattan Institute. What about Bill de Blasio in New York saying he wants to tax the rich in order to pay for all-day preschool? Is that a pragmatic solution to a problem in big cities? Is that something, do you think, that others will pick up?
No, I mean, I don't think de Blasio's appeal is pragmatism. I think it's just that. He promised voters he'd give them free stuff with somebody else's money. I mean, what's not to love about that if you think that somebody else is going to give you free stuff? And I think we do have a problem in that we don't have a lot of opportunities economically, so we have so greatly expanded this type of redistribution that it is creating a lack of an idea of a commonwealth in which it's everybody's now fighting who has to pay, who gets, and it's producing a very unhealthy situation.
Kenneth Cooper, back to you with the Trotter Review, University of Massachusetts in Boston. Do you think that we have an unhealthy situation developing?
Well, it could be. You know, I was just listening to Jennifer talk about big city suburban cooperation and her earlier comments about mass transit. In the Boston area, the regional transit system, the ride the subway is one fare for everybody no matter how far you go. And it's greatly inequitable, especially for people who live in the city, don't have a lot of money, have to use the MBTA, the T, and they pay the same as a suburbanite who's taking the subway much longer distances. I can imagine that any effort to change that system so that fares would be based on how far you go would be greatly resisted by suburban governments that also contribute to the funding of the system, and it probably wouldn't happen for a long time, if at all. So I think there are some tensions that will surface, and that's one example I'm familiar with here in my own backyard.
What about the perception that mayors are offering people free stuff with somebody else's money, as Aaron Wren put it?
Well, I understand that point of view, but another way of looking at it is that these children getting early childhood education and doing better in school actually relieve the wealthy of some later expenditures for their dependencies, like being locked up, committing crime, and the like. So, I mean, I think you could look at it as an investment as well as, you know, a transfer from one group to another that, you know, represents free stuff.
Aaron Wren, is that a proposition, do you think, that Republicans ultimately will come to accept?
In what regard?
If you provide education now, if you provide a better transportation system, if you do the kinds of things that Jennifer Bradley is suggesting and Kenneth Cooper is suggesting as well, that you won't have to pay down the road for a society that's falling apart and riddled with crime.
I think conservatives clearly believe in spending money on education and transportation, other matters. I think the problem is when you appeal to, you know, I'm going to divorce you from having to make any economic calculation about whether there's a cost benefit to what you're doing because we're going to sock this tiny group of people over here with the bill. I just think that's disingenuous. It doesn't promote good policy discussion, and it produces a two class society instead of a society in which everyone is basically in the same boat because we all broadly share the costs and benefits.
So, Thomas Edsel, is this phenomenon we're talking about likely to backfire?
In what sense do you mean backfire? You mean?
Well, Aaron Wren says that doing the kinds of things we're talking about may exacerbate the divisions rather than improving them.
Well, that's what I was arguing myself, too, that it could. I'm not sure that it will. The argument that investing now has a payoff later, for example, in education, is true, but it's hard to persuade people to give up money now on the on the gamble that something in the future will pay off. People tend to live in the present, and it's even when those arguments are entirely valid, they're not easy political sells. Just like the problems with Obamacare, with all the problems we have now, the pro-Obamacare people are saying, well, in the long run, this is going to all look good. But people like the way Democrats are now scrambling to cope with the current problems of Obamacare. The present moment is what dominates politics and often voters' decisions. And if those are zero-sum decisions or choices where someone else gains at your expense, it's very hard to sell that, sell the argument that maybe it's going to cost you now, but it'll pay off in the future.
So, Jennifer Bradley, once again then, isn't the current situation liable to mitigate against what you were talking about at the very beginning of the program, namely that coalitions need to be assembled in the interests of everybody so that there can be progress in the future? Isn't that a very difficult argument to put across?
No, because, again, I've seen it work in so many places that I know that it is a real and realistic thing to talk about. Also, I think we're talking about a hypothetical group of New Yorkers, takers and givers. If you look at some of the things that have come out of the business community of New York, right, the Partnership for New York City, they are also very concerned about lack of opportunity. They are also very concerned about New York students not being college or career ready when they come out of high school. So I think there is probably more ground for commonality, right? If you talk about pre-K as we're going to take money from rich people and give it to poor people, that's not a way to build a coalition. If you talk about workforce empowerment, if you talk about skills pipeline, which are also true, right? This is what Kenneth Cooper was talking about. That creates the setting for a whole different kind of conversation. And I think de Blasio is a smart enough fellow. And I think that the groups that represent wealthier New Yorkers or business interests are also pretty smart. And I think they know that nothing good is going to happen if they all fold their arms and lob these verbal bombs at the other guy. I think they will work together and they'll find a vocabulary and a set of initiatives to work together on. Otherwise, the city's just going to stop working and nobody wants that. Nobody benefits from that.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Thank you all very much. Jennifer Bradley at Brookings, The Metropolitan Revolution is her book. Thomas Edsall is at the Columbia Journalism School. His book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Aaron Wren publishes the Urbanophile website. It contributes to City Journal and works for the think tank Manhattan Institute, conservative group. And Kenneth Cooper is a freelancer, editor of the Trotter Review, Journal on Black Studies and Race Relations at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Thank you all. Good to have you with us. Quote, in an age of conspicuous consumption, the global recycling business has taken on the burden of cleaning up what you don't want and turning it into something you can't wait to buy. That's from a new book called Junkyard Planet, about an essential aspect of globalization that is mostly hidden from view. We'll talk with him in a moment on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren, I'll be back with today's talking point. Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview, and he's a familiar voice on this program. Now he's author of the new book, Junkyard Planet, about an industry that supported generations of his own family and is now very evident in China. Adam Minter, welcome to our program.
Great to be here, Warren.
Briefly, if you can, take us from the family business in Minnesota to the vast recycling industry in China.
Well, sure. I grew up as a third generation junkyard kid. My great grandfather emigrated from Russia. He wanted to be a vaudevillian, but he couldn't do that in early 20th century Galveston. So he did what I call the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. He started picking up people's trash on the streets, and I grew up in this business, you know, almost 75 years after he started doing it, and eventually moved to China, where I started covering it as a journalist in 2002.
How different does it look in China from the way it looked when you were at home?
Well, what's interesting to me is when I first started getting to China and visiting Chinese junkyards, I started seeing all the stuff that we used to send from our junkyard to China. You know, you'd start seeing the old telephone cables and electric motors. What was interesting to me was, unlike our junkyard in Minnesota, in China it was largely populated by labor. We used machinery to process things. But I can remember still to this day the first Chinese scrapyard I ever went into. It was a warehouse with about 500 women hand-sorting fragments of American automobiles that had been shredded all over the United States. And I'd never seen anything quite like that. It was epic, cinematic, and really dating from October 2002, I knew I wanted to write a book about it.
What's the value in the shredded automobiles?
Well, there's a lot of value. You know, it's actually priced out by the pound, and depending on how it's been separated, the kinds of automobiles, where it was shredded, it can be a couple dollars a pound sometimes for that material. And if you think, you know, it's coming over in containers that weigh, you know, as much as 40,000 pounds, you can sense the value. The United States every year exports several billion, I believe it's $11 billion worth of recyclables just to China, and about $40 billion of recyclables to the world as a whole. So this is an enormous business, and that's just the United States we're talking about.
So do the Chinese then take that material, manufacture it, and sell it back to us?
They sure do. I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing about it. The example I like to use, and it's not just scrap metal. Think of a Nike shoebox. You buy a box of Nikes in L.A., throw that box into your recycling bin. That box is going to go to Shenzhen, China, where it's probably going to be turned into a new box at a factory that manufactures Nike shoeboxes, and those Nike shoes will be sent back to China or to the U.S. again in a box, and the cycle keeps going on and on and on. Everything that you own, if it doesn't have recyclable content in it, is touched by it. I mean, we think of recyclables and scrap and junk as something that's separate, that, you know, is maybe a niche industry. But actually, in China, roughly half the copper that they manufacture, and that's the world's leading copper manufacturing country, comes from recycled resources, and most of it's imported. The same could be said about things like paper. China's the world's largest paper importer. Your car, the engine, is probably made from recyclable aluminum. The taillights are made from recycled plastic. It's a much bigger industry than just the one that we commonly think of, you know, the post-consumer waste greeting card, say. It suffuses our very life.
What about the labor conditions? What about the impact on the environment of the installations that you refer to in China?
Well, it varies. When you talk about China, it's actually gotten better in the 10 years, the 11 years, actually, that I've been covering it. But, you know, just 11 years ago, even 7 years ago, you could go to some of these places, and you knew you were getting close to a recycling zone because of the black cloud of smoke that hung over it. People would be burning things like wire so they could get rid of the insulation and then extract the wire. In fact, that stopped happening. So you see marginal improvements, but I think the biggest improvement, and the one that's very unexpected, is the wage for the workers. When I first started covering this in 2002, workers were making about $80 a month in these facilities, plus room and board. Today, they'll make as much as $800-$900 a month, and most of them don't want to have the room and board. They'd like to go and live in their own homes. That's an extraordinary change, and in fact, it's such a big change, and their value of their labor, because sorting metal is a skilled, it's a skilled task. It's such a valued activity that most of them are actually paid more than the college graduates working in the offices of the businesses where they're employed.
In your book, you talk about the environmental troubles that are caused by recycling in China, but you also point out that the alternative is mining, and that mining might be even worse. How do you split the difference?
Well, right. I mean, we tend to think of recycling, I think, as sort of a black and white, or if you will, black and green kind of thing. It's either or. But the fact of the matter is, all of us as consumers are going to use raw materials. China, as the world's largest consumer of raw materials, is going to get raw materials. If they can't get it from recycling, they're going to go and drill for it. They're going to go clear-cut forests for it. They're going to go and mine for it. And so, you know, instead of saying, you know, it's either recycling or mining, it's really a matter for us, I think, of saying, what is the least impactful way of getting our natural resources, our raw materials? You know, certainly the recycling industry has lots of room for improvement, especially in the developing world. But one of the points I make in the book is that no matter how bad the recycling is, in my experience, the worst recycling is still better than the best mining. I'd rather see an ugly wire stripping operation in southern China than I would, where they extract copper, than I would a new copper mine dug into the mountains of Tibet. These are difficult, you know, hairs to split at times, but I think as consumers we need to start thinking about them because we're entering a period of resource scarcity as the world develops further.
So you're very much in favor of recycling. You also say there is dignity in the trash business.
You bet there is. I mean, as somebody who grew up in it, I tend to take personally some of the imagery that we see, you know, of Chinese scrap metal workers, often depicted as just by the images as enslaved, exploited. But, you know, a lot of these activities that we see these workers doing are things that my family did and other immigrant families did in the early 20th century right up to, you know, the 1970s. And you know, they did it and we did it because it was a way to make a living. We didn't have other options. And it's the same in China. I've seen, you know, it as a route in China as it was in the United States to middle-class respectability. There's nothing wrong with cleaning up other people's messes. People, you know, are not exploited when they do it. They're making a rational economic choice for them. It's the sometimes the employment opportunity of last resort, or oftentimes it's the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. There's dignity in that.
The book is Junkyard Planet. The author is Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg World View. And if you want to know where that stuff you throw away really goes and what happens to it and whether you're likely to buy it again, it's a great read. Thank you, Adam, very much for being on our program once again.
Thanks so much, Warren.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.